Speaking of reliability. Friends talking about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. My name is Chris Jackson.
And my name is Carl Carlson. And we're just sitting around the virtual coffee table and having a discussion about reliability. So feel free to listen in and join us towards the end if you have questions, that type of thing. But Chris and I were talking before we started the recording about the subject of reliability engineering and how it relates to reliability management. So I thought that would be fun to talk about. Are they different subjects? Are they part of the same subject? When do you use one? When do you use the other? So, Chris, let me just kick it off, and I'll pick up from some of my experience years ago. Back in the late 1980s, I picked up GM's reliability group. And at that time, the focus was, I would say, 100% reliability engineering. And it was really narrow because there were only a certain number of tools that were used. And I quickly learned as we got assigned to different car programs, as I got involved with different car and truck programs, that there is this subject called reliability management, which is just as important on how you influence managers and this type of thing. And that took up which tools do you use, which ones don't you use, and why. So I just thought that'd be fun to chat about. What's your experience with reliability engineering versus reliability management?
Yeah, and as we discussed earlier, Carl, from my perspective, they are different sides of the same coin. You can't treat one as you would the other. There's plenty of reliability engineering activities you can do which add little to no value to whatever your measure of effectiveness is, what your business is there to do. It really is the skill of the reliability manager to firstly align the efforts of an engineer and make the case to those who enable the reliability team to do their job. And usually we're talking business case and understanding the business of the organization. That's something the reliability engineer doesn't necessarily need to know. Is that sort of aligned with your experiences?
Yeah, it does. Back, I'm going to say about 20 to 25 years ago, I got involved with one of the SAE teams. It was in the mid-1990s. And the Department of Defense in the U.S. was transitioning from MIL standards to commercial standards. There was actually a memo by William Perry, the then DOD secretary. And he was talking about transitioning from military to commercial. And SAE picked up the ball, and one of the MIL standards was 785, which is a reliability program. And the commercial standard then got picked up by SAE, and I was on that team. So we started listing out the different reliability tools and put up a kind of a common template or, you know, 1 to 3 pages on each reliability tool. And, okay, so you have a design of experiments. So what is it? When do you use it? What are the limitations? This type of thing. And we put all together into a handbook, and it really showed like 80 to 100 different reliability tools back then, and it's probably more today. And it's almost overwhelming to a new reliability engineer. How do you know which tools to use and when do you use them? And so that was my first big introduction to the topic. I'd been involved in reliability programs, and I developed reliability plans, but I never listed them all out on one place before to see what a daunting subject it is for a reliability engineer.
Exactly. And I think a reliability engineer often is going to be guilty of going to the same toolbox over and over again. If they're not getting any guidance or they don't understand what's trying to be achieved, you're going, human beings tend to get locked into what they did previously and got away with or achieved the outcome. And I think a really enlightened reliability manager is able to decipher those standards, decipher that list of activities and things that you just mentioned, Carl, and work out which ones apply to their organization. And after that, work out if you need to develop your own unique tool or approach. Most high-functioning reliability or highly reliable organizations, yes, they'll have some standard tools, but I haven't seen one where they haven't at least customized a tool for their own purposes.
Yeah, exactly. I've seen that very often. And those of you that know my background, I used to manage GM's reliability group for many years, product reliability. And we had quite a number of reliability engineers back then. And they were individually, many of them had, I'll call them hobby horses. And so they would say, okay, halt is the end all be all to everything. So on every program, we're going to get halt. And maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Same with FMEA. Very potentially powerful tool when it's used in the right circumstances, but not on everything. Same with, you name the tool. There are specific circumstances to use it and when not to use it, but people have habits and they have successes. And so they oftentimes people will tend to use a specific tool in circumstances when it isn't necessarily the right one to use.
Exactly. And I'd also go one step further that for the reliability engineering domain, a lot of people are, let's call them accidental reliability engineers. Not a lot of people actually get out of graduate high school saying, I want to be a reliability engineer.
Right. And you sort of stumble into it.
Yeah, stumble, fall, or in some cases are pushed into it. And
yeah.
If it's not your, let's be frank. I've seen some people who struggle at, let's call it their chosen engineering discipline, and they just then become the quality guy. They become the reliability guy. They're the ones who drew the short straw, or just weren't hugely competent at what they were originally employed to do. So they fall into the reliability role, and especially if they have a good quick win, if they do something which saves a day once. That is almost certainly what they will do forever and ever after that. A key thing about reliability is it's a mindset, as you know. It's a continual improvement. And the tools that worked when your organization was going from a very low maturity level to a not-so-low maturity level are not appropriate when you're trying to advance even further and become more strategically focused.
Yeah. You know, just a side comment on this is, I've seen that what you're talking about, where someone has a particular job and then they end up catching the ball and sort of take on the role. There's also quite a number of people that make an educational path out of it, get a master's mm-hmm. degree in reliability or get a PhD or some type of undergraduate work that focuses on quality reliability, and then get hired in to mm-hmm. make it a career. And I think the comments apply to either group of people. Let me just tell a little story here. I'm thinking back to the early 1990s when we first brought Junichi Taguchi to GM. Mm-hmm. And he gave talks and we were all excited about doing Taguchi methods. And then came the order from certain chief engineers to start developing our Taguchi projects on all new products. And that didn't go over too well because it's not really the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. We don't want to learn about a new tool and then suddenly start applying it to everything. And so I started to think about, when do you use Taguchi methods, or when do you use design of experiments, or when do you use fill in the blank? And I don't know that those, I'll call them trigger criteria or selection criteria, are well known. I've attended classes in a lot of different quality reliability tools, and those classes are designed around the assumption that you're going to use the tool, not necessarily on when you don't use it or why you do or why you don't, what the trade-offs are. So a lot of, to me, what informs my career on reliability management is a very careful eye on which tools to use and when, what characteristic or what trigger characteristics there are, and what skill levels of people should be associated with what tools and what's worth investing in, that type of thing. And I think all of that is really good thinking for reliability engineers who want to move towards reliability management. Another question, Chris, is it a good thing to do for reliability engineers to get involved with reliability management? What are your thoughts?
I absolutely think it is an essential part of any reliability practitioner or engineer's career path, even if you still want to be, you know, primarily a maker facilitator, or let's just say that you found your niche. I think that at some level you need to understand how your activity fits in with the design and the maintenance and operational and asset management, let's call it framework. I do think also, though, we need to have subject matter experts for certain areas. And I've met plenty of people who really passionately want to just do, you know, facilitate RCMs, for example, and nothing else. And that's okay. But they need to know the limitations of the RCM. I think it reinforces what you're saying before with the hobby horse comment. You need to know what the limitations of your technique are and when you do and don't apply them.
That's a good way to frame it, Chris. It's probably worthwhile for listeners to think about their favorite tools, the ones they use the most, and then ask themselves, when do you use it? When don't you use it? What are the limitations of the tool? What assumptions go into the tool? I remember taking my first, well, I've taken probably 5 or 6 Weibel classes going all the way back to some of the originators, and in those classes, I remember asking the question, well, wait a minute, how do I know that this is the right tool to use for this particular set of data? And back then, whoever the instructor was, I won't name names, stumbled on it and just sort of brushed it off, saying, well, this is how you do it, not when do you use it. Or what are the limitations? Sometimes the data failures that go into the Weibel analysis may not be appropriate. There may be assumptions that go into it. I'll take one obvious one. How about we talk about reliability prediction? The reliability prediction, there are people that have made careers out of it. There are other people that have said, I'll never do another one. It should never be used. It's a really hot topic. So those that are doing reliability predictions, I ask you, what are the limitations of reliability predictions? What are the assumptions that are going into your models? Are they appropriate? And so this whole subject is part of that transition from reliability engineering to the reliability management. And Chris, I agree with you. I think every practitioner should at least get some exposure to reliability management and put together, kind of the minimum to me is to be able to put together a plan. If you want to go to this objective, what are the steps to do it? Which tools should you use and how do you go about it? That's sort of the minimum. Then you can move into all the other area of soft skills where you get into project leadership and things like that.
One question I'll ask you, Carl, is there any tool which is as close to ubiquitous as any other tool? As in, is there a tool that in as virtually all applications you're going to use it at least once?
Good question. I think reliability requirements definition is probably to me one of the most pervasive tools.
Yep.
I'm hard-pressed to think of a project where I wouldn't start with reliability requirements of some kind. Now, how you do it? Do you do requirements identified as with a certain metric, like MTBF, or not?
Yep.
Yes. And, or do you use other metrics? I mean, those are all part of the methodology and the characterization of reliability requirements, but that's one that's pretty pervasive. Another one that's close to that is conditions of use.
Mm-hmm.
Developing and identifying conditions of use. It's so often used. And then, so you and I could probably develop a cascading list
mm-hmm.
of what are the most predominant and what are the rare ones. Some of the rare ones are really good, but only under very limited circumstances.
Yep.
Some of the more common ones are pretty good, but are used more commonly, not necessarily breakthrough type of things. I mean, this opens up a completely different subject, but it's similar, which is what I call traditional reliability
mm-hmm.
versus advanced reliability.
Yep.
Advanced meaning you're into physics of failure modeling and tools that are very unique and very skilled, very honed, very powerful under selected circumstances, as opposed to FMEA, which is not as advanced, can be used without the master's degree that might be required in physics of failure modeling,
mm-hmm.
But can be very powerful and is used more often. So there's like different dimensions of how you look at this subject.
And I'm glad you've talked about reliability requirements, because I think a lot of people don't understand how hard that is to get right. And it comes back mm. to reliability management, as in you need to know what the reliability of your product needs to be to support your business plan, how much profit you make. Sometimes it needs to be very, very high. Sometimes, especially if you're going to use it in a different scenario, it doesn't need to be that high. So, for example, people might have recently heard about Anak Krakatau, which is the volcano which erupted again in Indonesia, causing a tsunami which killed, I think, several hundred people. That's the remnants of the Krakatoa volcano, which erupted in 1983. And the reason we know so much about that particular eruption today, as in the one that happened very, very recently, was because a company called Planet.com, which has a bunch of little microsatellites going around the Earth, was able to image do the before and after of the volcano mount and see how much material was lost. Reason I'm talking about that as an example is because microsatellites, nanosatellites, they operate in constellations. That is, we launch potentially hundreds of them. And the reason we do that is because it's a very, let's call it envelope pushing technology, and reliability is difficult to achieve. But it doesn't matter if you launch 100 of them and you only need 70 of them to work. The calculus has been done in terms of cost benefit analysis, and it's actually much cheaper to launch three satellites in terms of reliability versus one highly reliable satellite.
Mm, interesting.
So getting your requirements right is actually, more than anything else, a business process.
Oh, you're so right. I remember that one of the first times I got introduced to this is when I started interacting with systems engineering, and I learned that every one of the ILITIs
mm-hmm.
has a place at the table, and the table is the project and the project manager. And I can stand there and wave my hand and go, hey, we got to have high reliability. And someone else says, wait a minute, we got to meet our cost objectives. And somebody else says, no, we need to meet this performance objective. And somebody says, no, we need to meet this whatever. And it is all about business trade-offs, because you never achieve 100% reliability, although there is an entirely separate subject, and it would be a good one for a podcast, the subject of safety.
Mm-hmm.
As different from reliability, but I just time permitting, that'll be another topic. I wanted to mention that those that are interested, and I hope you all are, in pursuing some degree of reliability management, it isn't the kind of skills that you learned in college. The college will give you the hard skills and the textbooks and this type of thing. There's a lot of softer skills that will help you in reliability management. And that's a lifelong pursuit. That's a pursuit of interacting with teams, influencing teams, helping them make the right decisions, and a whole set of topics that you won't necessarily get in Reliability 101 or the other courses in reliability unless you pursue them. So I think it takes a conscious effort to walk the path and gain the skills that can move you into a good career that's benefited by reliability management experience.
Absolutely. And I think if you could, I won't say summarize, that's too strong a word, but a reliability manager needs to always have the first principles approach. What is it we're trying to achieve? What are the resources I have? Does this reliability activity work towards that aim or that goal? And go from there. You talked about advanced versus not advanced reliability before, but it's a continuum. You might do for a system a FAMICA and work out that the system reliability is driven primarily by two very particular failure mechanisms, and that's where you then might do your advanced physics of failure on those two failure mechanisms only, but it's still a combination of, let's call it the basic reliability activity of a FAMICA and the advanced reliability activity of a physics of failure analysis. So the reliability manager needs to oversee that continuum and that flow. And if you don't know how valuable your activity is, then you're often not going to get listened to as a reliability engineer. And that's perhaps also a very important point. If you're talking to a manager as an engineer, but you're not understanding what the manager or the leader or the chief financial officer is trying to achieve, they will stop listening to you very, very quickly.
Yeah, great point. Before we round off this podcast, let me ask you, Chris, other than reliability requirements and conditions of use, do you have any particular tools that you think are like way high on the list of they most always get used?
I think your FAMIAs and your FAMICAs. I can't think of too many scenarios where you would avoid them. Perhaps if you got a prototypical design approach where the previous model wasn't that far removed from this year's model, but I don't think the absence of a FAMICA has ever been a good thing in products I've been involved with.
Okay, excellent. And I would build on that and say that a FAMICA at the high level, like system level, yes, is very often done, and if not always, and then the lower levels, as you get to subsystems and components, they can be more selectively used, mm-hmm. as opposed to doing FMEAs on everything, which I don't advocate, because like a vehicle has 10,000 parts, it doesn't necessarily add value to do 10,000 FMEAs.
No, again, a reliability management decision. So for you reliability engineers out there, in the strictest definition, if you're not already, you need to become more relevant in your organization by understanding your value proposition.
Good summary. Rounding it off, if you are a listener that would like to ask a question, and we hope you are, then ascenderreliability.com has a place on it where you can ask questions, and we hope you do, because some of what the topics are that we're using for our podcasts are informed by listeners asking questions. So please feel free to do that. And Chris, I really enjoyed talking with you.
Absolutely. Look forward to doing it again sometimes, Carl, when I learn the power of speech again.
All right. Very good. See you later.
Thanks, Carl.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.